From Wales, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Galen Ross. And we're going to be talking, well, we're going to talk at least in part about his book on the elite serial killers, because assassination really has been a pattern of running this government for a long period of time, and people who get in the way are routinely assassinated. And there have been so many of them, but there are a few very, very prominent people that we often speak of, and yet they're always told, oh, it was the action of a lone nut. And of course it wasn't. It's part of a much bigger picture of maintaining control, and specifically anybody who wants to speak out as far as the monetary system is concerned can be certain that, well, if you're the President of the United States and you try to issue money that is not going to pay money or interest to the bankers, why, your longevity is very short. But with that as the background, let's go to Galen and see what he'd like to talk about. Hi, Galen. How are you doing tonight?
Stan, it's a pleasure to be with you again. I always enjoy being with you.
Well, why don't you, what would you like to talk about? Would you like to talk about the elite serial killers at least part of the time? What's
well,
on your mind?
I just, a minute ago, finished doing an analysis of the Obama's Economic Recovery Advisory Board.
All right, fine. Well, if you'd like to talk about that, we certainly can.
And 7 of the 15 are members of either the Council of Foreign Relations, Trilateral Commission, or Bilderberg.
Right.
7 out of 15.
Now, these are the economic advisors.
Yeah, the Economic Recovery Advisory Board that was just named this morning.
All right, fine. Well, now, is that the one with Paul Volcker?
Yeah. Okay. Paul Volcker was heading it, and of course, he's Bilderberg, Council of Foreign Relations, and Trilateral Commission.
And Group of 30. This is a new group we find out they've gotten. And you've got Timothy Geithner, and you've got Larry Summers. He's just low-level Council on Foreign Relations Bilderbergers. But the same people always are in charge of the finances, because the finances are the key.
That's right.
Well, you go right ahead with your ideas and thoughts.
Okay, I've also looked at the top cabinet people and his staff. And, of course, Hillary Clinton, she attended the 97 and probably the 2008 Bilderberg Conference. Bob Gates was CIA director, and he's a member of the CIA for 26 years and was counsel on foreign relations from 1983 on. Secretary of Treasury Timothy Franz Geithner, CFO member since 96. He attended the Bilderberg Conference in 04, 5, 6, 7, and 8. Bill Richardson.
No, he's also a member of the Trilateral Commission, the guy there.
No.
Okay.
Bill Richardson was nominated as Secretary of Commerce, but he had to withdraw because of problems. And Bill Richardson was CFR member from 1985 on, attended the 97, 99, and 2000 Bilderberg conferences. He had to withdraw because of some problems. Secretary of Homeland Security Janet Napolitano is a CFR member since 06. UN Ambassador Susan Rice, CFR member since 92. Trilateral Commission member since 2005. National Security Advisor James L. Jones, CFR member since 2000. And she attended the 05 Bilderberg Conference. And Director of National Economic Council, Lawrence Summers, CFR member since 1990, Bilderberg Conference in 98, 02, and 08, and Trilateral Commission in 2001. Director of OMB, Peter Orszag, O-R-S-Z-A-G, Orszag, I guess. CFR member since, from 96 to 2001. Economic Advisor, Paul Volcker. Already talked about him, CFR from 71. Bilderberg's 88, 92, and 97. Trilateral Commission from 93 on. And let's see, National Security Advisor James L. Jones, CFR 2000 to 2005, and the Bilderberg in 2005. Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Daschle, that was nominated but withdrew, was CFR from 2006 on, was Bilderberg in 2008. White House Counsel, Gregory Craig, CFR from 1972 to 76. Ambassador to the Middle East, George Mitchell, CFR from 93 to 2005. Special Envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan, Richard Holbrooke, Bilderberg attendee, 95, 96, 97, 98, all the way up to 08, CFR member from 1970 on, Trilateral Commission from 1973 to today, and Veterans Affairs Secretary Eric Shinseski, CFR member from 2000 on. So there's essentially no change, Stan.
There's, well, of course, the whole idea is that
they've been surrounded by members of the elite.
Well, I think that most people find it very difficult that Barack Obama would get up and lie to the American people and say we're going to bring change. He's brought exactly the same people to surround him who surrounded every one of our other presidents, you know, for the last 4 or 5 decades. So it's the same people in control and the same people who created the economic crisis that we're in are the ones now we're supposed to believe are going to correct the economic crisis. And I believe they don't want to correct the economic crisis, because if they did, they would not be able to use the coming period of chaos and crisis and deprivation and economic problems to bring about their new world order. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Galen Ross, who's written a book we carry called A Who's Who in the Elite. A very good book, goes into the background of the other people, and certainly you have to understand that basically there's a little group makes up an invisible government. We have a visible government. Everybody knows about the visible government. There are congressmen, our senators, and they give speeches and talks, and they vote on legislation, and they pass laws, but they're not the people who run the country. There is an invisible government. It's really made up of the people from the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderbergers, the Council on Foreign Relations, the now, of course, a new group we're learning about, the Group of 30, and there's less than 5,000 of them here in the United States, and they really control the government. And they don't abide by our laws. The people like Sidney, Tom Daschle, he didn't pay his income tax. He didn't abide by the laws. He knew what he was doing. Sidney Timothy Geithner, the Secretary of the Treasury, he didn't pay his taxes either. And, of course, these people literally get away with murder, and many times the leaders of this organization do have people assassinated and removed. They are subversives. Many of them hold positions in government. They swear to uphold our Constitution, but they hate our Constitution. Their real motivation is to bring about a world government and to destroy our Constitution and our freedom. And I've been to the Council on Foreign Relations headquarters. I've been there several times, spending almost a week each time, been through their papers, and many times papers nobody else had gone through. There's no question at all that their goal has nothing to do with advising government and thinking about the problems. Their goal is to destroy the sovereignty of America and merge us into a one world government. You pick up the story there, Galen.
Yeah, and actually, David Rockefeller stated in his last memoirs that were just published a couple of years ago that he couldn't have done, or they could not have reached the point they have in dominating the entire world without the full cooperation of the press. And he gave full credit for that.
And for basically on page 405 of that memoirs, okay, where he talks about the fact, you know, there's some people who accuse the Rockefeller family of just having an inordinate influence on what's going on, you know, an inordinate influence on government. In fact, there's some who even think that we are part of a secret cabal that is dedicated and plotting with others throughout the world to bring about a new international order. And if that is the charge, I stand guilty, and I am proud of it. Those are his words, page 405 of the memoirs. We do carry that book. We want you to read what he says. Some people say we're part of a secret cabal, and if that's the charge, I am guilty, and I'm proud of it. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the man who is the permanent honorary chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations, having served as the vice chairman 15 years, the chairman 15 years. He is the honorary chairman today. He organized and leads the Trilateral Commission. He's a permanent member of the Bilderbergers. He is represents the wealthiest family, or one of the two or three wealthiest families in the world. The strong ties to the people who financed communism in Russia, Nazism in Hitler's Germany, and understand that, in fact, his nephew, of Stephen Rockefeller, even wrote the Earth Charter, where they really lay out the plan, what this is all about. And if you get the Earth Charter, it's up on the Internet, they talk about in point 10A and 10B, the whole idea is to equitable distribution of wealth within nations, of course that's socialism, and equitable distribution between nations. In other words, they're going to transfer our wealth to other nations, not his wealth, our wealth, because, of course, he believes that he is part of the ruling elite. In fact, he told one of my friends, Congressman Dannemeyer, the one time, just off the cuff, you know, some men are born to rule, but most men are born to be ruled. And ladies and gentlemen, he's talking about you. You common people out there. There is a ruling elite. They control successive administrations. Doesn't matter whether you get a Democrat or Republican in. They control them. They put them in office. And, of course, if they get out of line, why, they send them on a trip to Dallas. Go right ahead, Galen.
One of my dearest friends is a member of the Japanese royal family, and she's written a couple of books, and she said in one of her books that the Rockefeller family in 1998 was worth $11.48 trillion, with a T, trillion dollars.
I believe it. But, of course, the American people honestly believe that Bill Gates and Warren Buffett are the richest men in our country. And that is, of course, simply, that's what you're supposed to believe. You believe what you read, and most of it is a lie. Are those books available here in the United States?
I'm going to be the publisher once she gives the release on it, but she hasn't given me the release yet.
Well, you get the release, and you get the book published, and we'll carry it for you.
Yeah, I've already got them written. They're ready to go to press, but I can't do it until she gives me the go-ahead. Last time I talked to her, she said, now's not the time, and I don't know what her concern was. But
well, I don't think it's ever the time to tell the truth, because, of course, if you tell the truth, why, you may end up in a plane crash. In fact, I just got a call from my friend Dr. Dennis Cuddy telling me about an article on the Internet about a gentleman who was about ready to testify about the part he played in rigging the elections in 2004 that made George Bush the president of the United States, and they simply rigged the election there in Ohio. He was ready to come forward, and then his little plane crashed, and he just up and died. Well, wasn't that convenient for the Bush family? Go right ahead.
Yeah, I guess that pretty well covers some of the current events, unless you'd like to get into the assassinations.
Well, I think that's always a good subject. Would you like to get into the assassinations? Because, of course, this goes right along with the fact that there is a ruling elite that's been around, well, since our country was formed. It's always been a ruling elite out there. But, of course, when you understand the spiritual implications, this goes on through the millennium. And, of course, many of the families, powerful families we see here today, why, you can trace them back hundreds of years in the history of our nation, and even before that, before the foundation of our nation. And some of these people, the families, are deeply involved in the occult. from generation to generation to generation. I would give you one example, and that would be the Bush family. From Prescott Bush, who was actually indicted, you know, for helping the Nazis during the course of the Second World War, and his bank, of course, Brown Brothers Harriman. He was a member of the Skull and Bones, a Luciferian society, to his son, George Herbert Walker Bush, who became the President of the United States, the 41st, I guess, and then, of course, his grandson, George W. Bush, also a member of Skull and Bones. They've all come from the same Luciferian society. And were they actually there in the tomb? And we've got a great deal of information. Even talk to people who've studied this and have agents who've gone into the tomb. All the Nazis, you know, replica Nazis insignias, the swastikas on the wall of the tomb. And they routinely sing Deutschland über alles. And of course, they're probably the Skull and Bones is a branch of this, the international organization, international fraternity, ties into the mystery religions aimed at bringing a world government. So secret that when Tim Russert asked George Bush what he was running in 2004, if he could talk about it, the Skull and Bone Society, George Bush said, oh, it's so secret, I can't talk about it. But his opponent, the Democratic candidate for presidency, was John Kerry, Senator John Kerry. And when Tim Russert asked John Kerry about it, he said, oh, it's so secret, I can't discuss it. Go right ahead, Galen.
Well, I called the Yale Library Archives this morning, and because I've got a couple of gaps in my list of Skull and Bones members, and I asked for some specific names, and they said that since 1985 was the last time that they published the members in their annual, school annual, and since from 86 on, they keep it absolutely secret. There's no official records there at Yale.
Well, I have the records up to 85, but I don't have them after that. I think you see that they can't let the American people understand that they can. Their agents are in all political parties and always in positions of power. But then, of course, there are other parallel organizations. It's not simply Skull and Bones. The Trilateral Commission, which is an occult organization, 86 members. You know, and we've calculated that 11 of those 86 members hold key positions in the Obama regime. But go right ahead, Galen.
Okay, I'm now working on a DVD that I'll have available in the next 2 or 3 months that will have the full list of members of the Skull and Bones, the Council of Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, and the Bilderbergs from the day that they were formed. And that's something I've been working on since 1992, but I'm finally going to bring it to head in the next couple of months. And I'll make that available, and I'll send you a copy.
All right, we'll look forward to getting that. All right, well, let's get talking about the elite serial killers. This is a book that Galen has written. It goes into the background of the murder of Abraham Lincoln. It goes into the background of the murder of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, and Martin Luther King. They were all assassinated, and of course, certainly James Earl Ray did not kill. You know, Martin Luther King, the family doesn't believe that. They even hired a lawyer and brought a case against the gentleman who was involved in it, who readily admitted he had been part of it. He was dying at the time. And after 4 months, the jury found that the CIA was behind the whole thing, and not a word of it in the controlled media. We got a great 4 tapes out on that, but I'm going to let Galen tell you the story of the elite serial killers. But of course, at least two of the men, John Fitzgerald Kennedy and Abraham Lincoln, were killed, and I think a large part of their murder was the fact that they wanted to take the power of money creation away from the financiers. They wanted the government to issue its own money. You see, right now, of course, for every dollar that is issued by the Federal Reserve System, we have to pay interest on that. And who do we pay it to? We pay it to the bankers. Why do we have to pay interest, you know, on our own money? Because it's not our own money. It is issued by the bankers, for the bankers, to enrich the bankers. Go right ahead, Gary.
And the Federal Reserve is actually unconstitutional. Our Constitution says that only Congress has the power to create.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four-tape or a four-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that'll protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
I know what it's like to lay awake at night and worry about mounting credit card debt. That nagging feeling in the pit of your stomach that just won't go away. And the phone calls from collectors. Forget about it. Then I called Help You Out of Debt. Their professional staff of debt mediators were able to help me get my upside down finances back on track and help stop the phone call. My Help You Out of Debt settlement specialist understood exactly what I was going through. My specialist was able to get creditors off my back, negotiate huge reductions on most of my balances, and help me fight back against the credit card companies. Help You Out of Debt specialists are experts in debt mediation and settlement. They are on your side. They've helped thousands of people just like me and can help you too. Call now and get a free debt review. If you're $10,000 or more in credit card or unsecured debt and ready to start fighting back, call 866-374-3101 and get your free debt review. That's 866-374-3101 or on the web at helpyououtofdebt.com. 866-374-3101.
A credit default swap is a type of a derivative. And there are probably somewhere between 600 trillion and $1 quadrillion worth of these unfunded insurance policies out there backing the bonds that have been issued throughout the world. And how can they possibly be paid for? The banks don't have that sort of money. That's 10 times all the money that's in the entire world. But, of course, the government has said, well, these banks that have written them are too large to fail, so we're going to bail them out. And the way they bail them out, since we don't have the money, we can't borrow the money, we can't tax the people to raise it. Why, we'll just print the money. And they're starting to print the money now. They've turned on the printing presses, and very soon we'll be just like they are in Zimbabwe today, as they were in the Weimar Republic back in the 1920s. The average American doesn't understand that our leaders intend to destroy this nation. Why? Because they want a one-world government. Go right ahead, Galen.
Yeah, as they print this money to so-called bail us out or bail whoever out, when they print this money, that just adds to the overall money supply, and as they add to the money supply, that's hyperinflation. And as you just said, there are several nations around the world that have experienced hyperinflation, and I saw some bills on, it seemed like it's Zimbabwe or something like that, where they had some like $500 million bills.
Well, they recently issued a $50 trillion bill in Zimbabwe, a $50 trillion bill.
And to buy enough food to feed the family, you'd have to have a wheelbarrow full of that money to go to the local store to buy anything.
Except they don't have anything at the local stores. That's the thing. The stores are empty. People don't understand. The United States State Department put that government in over the objection of these Rhodesian people. We have kept this ruthless communist dictator in power. I think they just want to see how effective it can be in destroying a nation. They've destroyed Zimbabwe. You have financed it, and you are responsible for what your State Department has done, because men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. And if you look and see what's going on in Zimbabwe today, this could well be going on in America in another few years. Go right ahead, Caleb.
Okay. Well, we might get back on the assassinations. Of course, the Lincoln was killed by John Wilkes Booth, but I found out who paid him. When he killed Lincoln, he had $8,000 in a saddlebag on his horse. Now, he was an unemployed actor at the time, so where could he get that sort of money? And it turned out that he got that money from the Rothschilds in London. And so John Wilkes Booth, a lot of people think he was killed in that tobacco barn. Well, the soldiers did follow Booth and his companion to the tobacco barn, and they didn't know that there were three people in there instead of two, and so they said, come out or we'll shoot, and they didn't come out, so they started shooting, and Booth slipped out the back door and got on his horse and made his way to the local port, got on a ship, sailed to London, went to the Rothschilds, got his final payoff, and from there he went to Bombay, India, and retired and died 14 years later of natural causes.
Now, where did you get that information? I know where you got it, but I want you to tell our listeners.
It came from a book titled This One Mad Act by Isola Forrester, who was John Wilkes Booth's granddaughter.
Right, I think it's important.
It's a 500-page book, and it's very interesting reading, and she interviewed a lot of the soldiers that were there that supposedly killed her grandfather, and they all said that Booth had red hair. Well, it was absolute fact that he had raven black hair, so he could not be the same person.
All right, fine. So basically, she tracked this whole story down. This was his granddaughter?
Yeah.
So, see, this is what was she writing this book about? What year do you recall?
I believe it was about 1931 or 1935
all right.
When it was published.
All right. So she was able then to talk to some of the people. Of course, that was about 70 years after the fact. So, but was she able to track him down over to India?
She got a hold of some letters that he had written to some of the relatives and friends of his, and tracked him down to Bombay. And I don't know that she ever saw his grave, but that's what she says. That's where he ended his life.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Galen Ross. And Galen, why don't you go ahead and pick up the story? You were just telling us about the murder of Abraham Lincoln, John Wilkes Booth. And of course, this is the part of history that nobody's ever heard of. And the last thing they want the American people to realize is that there was some sort of a tie-in between John Wilkes Booth and the international financiers who were furious with Lincoln because, well, why were they furious with Lincoln?
He created money. He needed to have money to finance the Civil War, and the Rothschilds were charging 24% and 36% interest on their money, and so he went to Solomon Chase, the Secretary of Treasury, and instructed him to print money, and so he printed over $449 million worth of greenbacks and put them in circulation to pay the federal debt, and it was very successful. And so the Rothschilds could not stand to have anyone create money and credit. That was their specialty. They had a monopoly on it around the world, and so that's the real reason that Lincoln was killed. Same reason that Kennedy was killed.
And I think it's so important that people understand that the whole thing about finance, most people don't understand where money comes from. Banks create money out of nothing. They keep a small fraction on reserves, and then they simply either print the money or they circulate the money. In those days, they used to actually print the money. Today, our money is printed by the U.S. Treasury, and then, of course, it's simply turned over to the Federal Reserve System, and they get interest on the money that the Treasury has printed until those bills are retired. The trouble is those bills are never retired, and so every year we have to pay interest to the banks that hold the stock in the Federal Reserve. There's only a small number of them, but of course, at least as far as we can determine, they're banks like the J.P. Morgan Chase and Citibank and a few of the others. And although every bank that belongs to the Federal Reserve holds some stock in it, the major things are held by the largest banks here in the United States, many of which, of course, have strong ties to the same European bankers and the same banking families that were there at the time of Abraham Lincoln. And that is the reason that they cannot let the American people understand. We have a privately owned central bank, controlled by men who established this central bank so that they could make money, so that they could control the destiny of our nation. What people don't understand is those who control the money do determine the destiny of our nation, and they take us from periods of affluence to periods of poverty and war after war after war, because they make great fortunes in wartime.
Yes.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Galen Ross. And Galen, would you like to get out your address, your website, before we go on?
Yeah, it's www.4rie.com. That's www.4rie.com.
And what does RIE stand for?
Ross International Enterprises.
Ross International Enterprises. And then, of course, I get it.
Toll-free number is 800-410-5571.
All right, well, let's go on with the story of the elite serial killers. So, basically, of course, Abraham Lincoln was killed by John Wilkes Booth, but most people have never heard the rest of the story, and that is that his grandfather had actually tracked down the story and found out that Wilkes did not die in the barn, that he actually ended up getting over to England, where he was paid off by the Rothschilds, and that he ended up dying in India many years later, but she had many of the letters he had written after he was supposedly died. And, of course, there was supposedly a conspiracy at that time. I think there were six people who were executed. But they were all the patsies. They could never let the American people know who was really responsible for the murder of Abraham Lincoln, any more than they could let the American people know who was really responsible for the murder of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, who was really responsible for the murder of his brother, Bobby Kennedy, who was really responsible for the murder of Martin Luther King. So you pick up the story, Galen.
Okay, well, let's go on to John Fitzgerald Kennedy. On June the 4th, 1963, he signed Executive Order 11110, creating instructing the Treasury Department to create money and put it in circulation, and they did it in the form of silver certificates. And they issued $4.3 billion worth of silver certificates, and I've got two or three of them myself, so I know they were in circulation.
And they were United States notes. They were not Federal Reserve notes. Is that right?
That's right, and you could go to a bank, any bank, and redeem them in the same amount of silver. But again, that he was killed for that same reason that Lincoln was killed, and I've been very lucky in my career to run across some people and of course it's divine guidance, but I won't get off on that subject, but. One of them was a lady named Madeline Duncan Brown. She turned out to be Lyndon Johnson's mistress for 21 years and gave birth to his only known son. And she became a dear friend of mine. I knew her for about 10 years, and she passed away about 3 years ago, 4 years ago. But every time I'd go to Dallas, we'd have lunch or dinner, and we'd talk about assassination. And so one day she said, I've known you long enough that I can trust you, so I've got to tell somebody. Can I tell you? And I said, what about? She said, about assassination. I said, certainly, I'd love to hear it. And so she just emptied her brains right there and went over the whole thing. And later she agreed to do that on video. And Stan has a copy of a video of this interview that I did with Madeline. And it's titled The Clint Merchant Meeting. And so the night before JFK was killed, there was Clint Merchant had a house off Preston Avenue in North Dallas. And so Madeline, when Lyndon was going to be in Texas, they would always arrange for her to be nearby in case he could get free to be with her. So in any kind of social event, Madeline was always invited. So she was invited to this Clint Merchant social event, and the stated purpose of the event was to honor J. Edgar Hoover, who was in town. And so there was something like a little over 50 people attended. And so around 11:15, 11:30, somewhere like that, the front door opened and Lyndon Johnson walked in. So Clint Merchant stood up and says, okay, now we can have our meeting. So 25 men went into the conference room and closed the door. And two of the people that were sitting in on that private meeting, I've interviewed personally. And one of them I've interviewed him on videotape. And one of these days I'll release that. But he talked about what went on in the meeting. And Cliff Carter was running the meeting. And Cliff Carter was chairman of the Democratic National Committee and headed most of Lyndon Johnson's campaigns. And so he said, well, what about the evidence? And Hoover stood up. He said, don't worry about the evidence. All evidence must come through the FBI, and I've got it locked. Don't sweat it. And so there's some other things went on, but that was the most outstanding statement made. But after the 20 or 30 minutes, the meeting broke up, and everybody came out into the social area, and Lyndon came over to Madeline Brown, who was sitting at her table, and leaned over, and she thought he was going to say, I'll meet you at the hotel at a certain time, but what he actually said, he leaned over, and his face was red, and he says, after tomorrow, that blankety-blank Kennedy will never embarrass me again. That's not a threat, that's a promise. And he called her the next day in the morning and from Fort Worth and made the same statement over the phone, and she was shocked by it, but never did talk about it with anybody. But anyway, let's just go over some of the names that were in attendance there at the secret meeting. It was at Clint Merchant's house. He was there. H.L. Hunt was there. Lyndon Johnson. George Brown, head of Brown and Root. John J. McCloy. Now, at that time, he was chairman of the Council of Foreign Relations and chairman of the Chase Manhattan Bank and former high governor of Germany after World War II. And he was an agent of the Rothschilds, so that's how I tie the elite into the killing of Kennedy, because the Rothschilds, through McCloy, said, we need to get rid of this guy, and so he was part of it, the conspiracy. Richard Nixon was there. J. Edgar Hoover and his playmate Clyde Tolson was there. Earl Cabell was there. He was mayor of Dallas from 1961 to 64. Ammon G. Carter, Jr., was founder of the Dallas Cowboys. R.L. Thornton was former mayor of Dallas. John Conley, at the time, was governor of Texas. Now, he was at this meeting discussing the killing going to take place the next day, and so you know that he was really sweating it out when they came to Dealey Plaza. And, in fact, several witnesses said that it was right near the car when the shots were fired, heard Conley say, "My God, they are going to kill us all." Now, Lee Harvey Oswald is not a they, so there has to be more than one. So he knew it was going to happen because he was in on that planning meeting. And let's see, Mack Wallace was at this secret meeting. He was Johnson and Cliff Carter's hitman, and he was responsible for probably close to two dozen killings in Texas and other places. And he's also one of the shooters from the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository the next day. Cliff Carter was running the meeting, so he was there. Now, also, there's Carlos Marcello, or Marcellus, depends on how you want to pronounce it, was the boss of the New Orleans Mafia. Joe Savello was head of the Dallas Mafia. And Jack Ruby was at this secret meeting. He was one of the underlings of the Mafia, and he was owner of the Carousel Club there in Dallas. And his fellow, Jimmy Hoffa, couldn't attend this meeting, so we sent his number one lieutenant, a fellow named Larry Campbell. Campbell was the black business agent for the Teamsters Local 299 in Detroit. So he was there to represent Jimmy Hoffa. And Bill Decker was there. He was sheriff of Dallas County at the time. He later became a Texas Ranger. He was just sheriff. Now, Clint Peoples was U.S. Marshal and became a Texas Ranger later. And so you have a number of people that represented law enforcement. You had at least three people, maybe four, representing the Mafia, and two or three representing the heavy oil industry, and one representing the banks. And all these people were plotting the cover-up of the murders going to take place the next day.
Now, you actually talked to somebody else who actually attended the meeting.
I talked to six people that attended that meeting socially.
I see.
Two of them attended the secret meeting.
All right, fine. Well, of course, and didn't one of them actually make you promise not to reveal he was there until he passed away?
That's right. And I have him on video, and I agreed not to produce that video until he's either no longer alive or until he gives me written permission.
All right, fine. So he was there. Of course, the thing is that you have Madeline Duncan Brown's testimony on video. I've seen it. Actually, we interviewed Madeline Duncan Brown, and the testimony and the story is essentially as you've told it. And here they were, of course, acknowledging the murder was going to take place the next day. But they had to have J. Edgar Hoover on board to cover this up. John, of course, McCloy was actually a member of the Warren Commission. Who better to put on the commission to cover up what was going on other than a member of the conspiracy? Of course, Lyndon Johnson appointed the Warren Commission not to reveal what had happened, but to conceal what had happened. And this is what happens with all of the government commissions they appoint. Do you honestly believe that you're going to give a government commission that's going to tell the truth? Because if they did, why, of course, they would have to be killed. That's just the way that it is. Could you imagine what would have happened at that time if the American people had realized how deep this conspiracy was? Do you think that Richard Nixon would ever become president of the United States? Or Hoover had been allowed to continue his nefarious activities, you know, and up until the time he died. But you pick up the story there.
Okay, so we've covered the secret meeting the night before the killing. Now, on the day of the killing, Kennedy and Johnson were in Fort Worth, and the back of my book, I've got a picture of Kennedy speaking, and there's three guy standing behind him, and one of them is Lyndon Johnson. He's got this scowl on his face looking at Kennedy, like, and his scowl sort of says, "Say what you want to, fella, and within 2 hours you're going to be dead." Of course, he didn't say that, but that was the look on his face. But they arrived in Dallas, and the Madeline told me that she was in the Carousel Club one day when Jack Ruby came in and had a piece of paper in his hand, and he flashed around and says, "Guess what I got, girls?" And so Manna says, "What do you got there, Jack?" And he says, "I've got the revised route for the presidential parade through Dallas, and it's going right through Dealey Plaza." And Madeline just laughed and said, "Oh, Jack, you just don't know what you're talking about," or something like that. She didn't know how accurate it was. But once the motorcade got into Dealey Plaza, they made a right turn and then went down a block and made a heavy left turn about 120 degrees or so. In order to make that turn, the limousine had to come almost to a halt, and as it then started accelerating, it was still going pretty slow by the time it got to the point of the shooting. But there were four shooting stations, and each one of them, there was a person manning a walkie-talkie radio. Now, Lyndon Johnson was about two or three cars back from Kennedy's car, and one of the guys said that was in a car with him said that Lyndon had his head leaning over against the window with his ear poked into that radio. And right after the shooting started, of course, he dropped the radio down, but they didn't really put any importance to that. But there was two shooters behind the picket fence on the grassy knoll. And that was Jack Graham was managing the radio behind picket fence, and John Ernst and Clyde Faust were the two shooters. And then from the top of the Dallas County Records building, Eugene Hale Brading was there with a rifle and a radio operator, and on the second floor of the Dowtech building, there's one shooter and one radio operator. Then on the sixth floor, there were two shooters. Lee Harvey Oswald was up there, but he didn't touch a gun that day. And but the two shooters were Lawrence Loy Factor, a Chickasaw Indian from Fillmore, Oklahoma, that had been recruited by Mack Wallace, and Mack Wallace was the other shooter. And Mack Wallace's job was to kill Carter, and I've never found out why they wanted to kill Carter. But the radio operator was a Hispanic lady, 20 years of age, named Ruth Ann, and I'm not sure about her last name. But she went up to Oklahoma to pick up Lloyd Factor to bring him down for the killing. Then on the second floor of the Dallas of the school book depository building, there's a group of people there just watching, and then Cliff Carter was there with a walkie-talkie radio, and he gave the orders to shoot. When he said shoot, the radio operators then repeated that order to the shooters, and they all fired six shots within a 3 or 4 second interval. Now, Sam Giancana was also on the second floor, and I've seen a picture of him coming out of the building shortly after the shooting took place. Jack Ribby was on the second floor, and George Reese was also on the second floor, plus two or three others.
Now, where did you get all the information who the shooters were? Where did that
Through one of my friends that has connections in the mafia.
I know. In other words, the mafia was able to tell you who was there. We know, for instance, if you read the book Double Cross by Chuck Giancana, the brother of Sam Giancana, he will tell you exactly he doesn't give you the details in Ross that you're getting here, but, you know, how that the mafia had done this as a hit for the CIA. But he told you, even more interesting, why Jack Ruby killed Lee Harvey Oswald. It was very simple. He was told he would either do it or he would be tortured to death, and everybody in his family would be tortured to death. The book, Double Cross. But of course, you're never going to hear that on ABC, CBS, or NBC. We'll go right ahead.
Okay,
we got 3 minutes to wrap up.
Jack Ruby also thought that if he killed Lee Harvey Oswald, that he would become a hero because he killed the person that killed the president.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look. And I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your 2-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
With food prices soaring to all-time highs, as the dollar continues to fall in value, what can you and your family do to guarantee that fresh, nutritious vegetables will make it to your dinner table? Garden in a Can. Garden in a Can is your source for premium, long-term storable seeds. Garden in a Can is ready when you are. Plant them now or store them for when you really need them. There are 16 large, hermetically sealed, non-hybrid, open-pollinated packets of seeds, along with detailed planting instructions sealed in a can for ultimate long-term protection. Garden in a Can. It's that simple. Fresh, healthy, easy. Only $69.95 for over a half acre of safe, fresh vegetables. Ready when you are. Stop procrastinating and start preparing with Garden in a Can. For more details, visit GardenInACan.com today. That's GardenInACan.com or call 866-598-7396, 866-598-7396.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-
Trilateral Commission, Bilderbergers, an excellent source of information. And then, of course, we carry his book, The Elite Serial Killers. We actually carry the the DVD he has of David Rockefeller talking about the world government. It's I don't know where he got the footage, but David Rockefeller is going to be talking for half an hour about his plans to unite the Western Hemisphere. Well, then, of course, we carry the books and we have a four-tape set on the murder of Martin Luther King. The book is called An Act of State. We have Galen's book, The Elite Serial Killers, going into the murder of Kennedy and Lincoln and Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King. But we actually have a four-tape set where you're going to actually hear the people who went to the trial, attended the trial, where the Martin Luther King's family brought a case against a gentleman who was part of the hit team, who actually admitted he was part of the hit team, and he did this. He was dying, and of course they had 50 witnesses there. And a 4-month trial, not a word in the controlled media here in the United States, because you can't know that they murdered Martin Luther King. And then, of course, we have a four-tape set on the murder of President Kennedy, where you'll actually hear Lee Harvey Oswald. It's called JFK. And then, of course, the Kennedy assassination. Then we have the Kennedy assassination update, and there you'll actually hear my 2-hour interview with Madeleine Duncan Brown, as she tells you about the meeting that was held the night before, where, of course, Lyndon Johnson, J. Edgar Hoover, Richard Nixon, the others were there planning the assassination of a president of the United States. And believe me, Madeleine Duncan Brown is very, very believable. She was the mistress of Johnston, President Johnston, for 15 years or more. So we have a great deal of information. We do hope that you want to get the material. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get the book written by the lawyer who was hired by Martin Luther King's family to bring the trial, to try to bring out the truth about his execution and the government's involvement, the book is entitled An Act of State. They're all available from Radio Liberty by calling 1-800-544-8927. We actually now have a supply of the book Target Patton. It goes into the background of the assassination of General Patton. And, of course, he was killed by the people working under orders from Wild Bill Donovan, who headed the OSS, because Patton had information. Had he brought it out when he had returned to the United States, it would have been very embarrassing for the establishment, who even at that time was intent upon the betrayal of our country, and of course joining together with Russia and Communist China and all the other countries of the world to bring about this one world government. The book Target Patton is very important, and of course we have 2 interviews with the author, Mr. Robert Wilcox, and we'll be putting together a 4-tape set on assassination, but you can get those 2 1-hour interviews, fascinating material you certainly won't hear elsewhere. We do hope, of course, if you've not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, that you want to get it. We hope that certainly you want to get our talk on the Forbidden Secret, on the planned police state and their syllabuses that go with both of those. We have the great new DVD, The Eye of the Phoenix. It's the 3rd in the series of the Secret Mysteries series. And then, of course, if you haven't laid in your supply of emergency food, don't put it off. We're heading into very difficult times. And, of course, if you need to get the Berkey water filters, why, we do carry them. If you'd like to have on hand, certainly some health products, the sort of things that you'd need. And the people from Garden in a can, they simply canned, hermetically sealed, seeds for long-term storage. They're advertising with Radio Liberty. Listen to our programs. You'll hear their ads. We recommend Garden in a can as well. And, of course, then we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And again, our number,
1-800-544-8927.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, and hopefully for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Mr. William Grigg, formerly senior editor of the New American Magazine, and now certainly working full-time actually writing a blog, managing the website for the Welch Foundation, appearing on radio programs, and we're always pleased to have William with us here on Friday evening right here at Radio Liberty. Hi, William. How are you doing tonight?
Dr. Stan, thanks so much for having me on as a guest again. I'm doing great. It's always a blessing to be with you.
Well, now, have you had your next child?
Yes. As a matter of fact, on Tuesday, Corinne went in, and we had little Justice Samuel Grigg. He was born at 9:12 a.m. local time on Tuesday. He was just a shade over 7 pounds. Much bigger than I was at birth, ironically enough. I'm a large man, but I was a very small child. And he's doing wonderfully. He looks remarkably like his oldest brother, William Wallace, who's 11 now. A little dark complexion, dark-haired little boy with very prominent eyebrows and a baritone cry. So we're just absolutely delighted to have him in our home. He's our sixth child, and his five older siblings are utterly enamored of him. They fight with each other for the privilege of seeing him and holding him. So
well, that's wonderful.
Corinne's doing very well, and it's a real blessing to have her home again now, too.
All right, so I'm so glad for that. Well, we've been thinking of you all week and hoping everything was going well.
I appreciate that.
Well, let's. What are we going to be talking about tonight?
Well, the thing we have to talk about, of course, once again, is this whole unraveling of the world financial system and the frantic efforts of the people who are the top echelons of this kleptocratic ruling elite to ensure that they're in a pretty good position to capitalize on the misfortune of the rest of us. There was a speech that Mr. Obama gave yesterday in Williamsburg, Virginia, to a group of Democratic congressional and party leaders that I think just perfectly embodies in a sort of capsule form the madness, the derangement of the people who are running this process and the way that they're trying to manipulate the fears of the public into supporting a program and a proposition that's going to ruin what remains of our prosperity. Mr. Obama, of course, has been pushing the so-called stimulus package, which is, to use the Latin phrase, the fancy Latin phrase, an omnium gatherum, that's just a fancy way of saying a grab bag or catch-all, of payoffs and perks and pork payments to various of the constituencies that have their snouts buried deeply into the government trough that serve the interests of the Democratic Party. It's just basically slopping all the familiar troughs with as much money as they possibly can appropriate and call it stimulus. It has nothing to do with building the type of sustaining, self-sustaining economic growth that can only come when you let the free market operate. And, of course, the Republicans have a different set of constituencies whose troughs they would like to slop. And so we had this really cute little dialectic for the last couple of days where the Republicans in the Senate were supposedly dragging their heels after the Republicans in the House voted against the so-called stimulus package. The Republicans in the Senate were putting on this great show of intransigence led by Tom Coburn of Oklahoma, who, from what I understand, is a pretty good man, but unfortunately has become somewhat Republicanized. But he gave a wonderful speech talking about the manifold evils of this so-called stimulus package. And then I saw him on television not 15 minutes later talking about the alternative that the Republicans want to propose, which is roughly half the size of the stimulus package, so-called, that the Democrats were proposing. So you've got something that is a huge, ungainly pile of pork, and the Republicans say, well, this is completely unconscionable. Let's reduce it by half.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
Go right ahead. The Republicans confronted with something that is just facially unacceptable in terms of what it represents by way of the familiar game of molting the productive to benefit the parasitical. They say it's completely abominable and utterly beyond the pale that we would do this to the tune of $800 billion. Let's only do it to the tune of $400 billion, which, of course, somewhat vindicates the old saw that all that Republican conservatives are people who tardily embrace whatever heresy the Democrats are promoting on a given week. So they were going to reduce it by half. They didn't have the votes to do that. Now we saw just this evening a compromise proposal that rather than being over $800 billion in spending, or actually it ballooned up to over $900 billion in socialist spending, would be only, quote-unquote, $780 billion, which is larger than the original $750 billion that Obama had proposed. And the Republicans, of course, would consider this a species of victory if it went through. But even that headline tonight was amended even later to say that, well, actually, the range is between $780 and $827 billion. Look, it doesn't matter what figure they put on it right now. I guarantee you, I'm not going to say that I would guarantee it in writing, but I would assure you that by the time they're finished with it, it's going to be over $1 trillion in size. And none of it has anything to do with actual economic growth. Promoting economic growth would mean that we would reduce the size of government. We would reduce the amount of spending that's going on. We would try to do what we can to restore some kind of sound and constitutionally appropriate governance to the economy by getting rid of the Federal Reserve, do what we could to reinstitute sound money as defined by the Constitution. But on route to doing all these wonderful and necessary things, the first thing we would do, if we were interested really in bringing about economic growth in the country, would be to reduce the amount of government spending by roughly $1 trillion. And instead they're talking about spending $1 trillion more on that familiar constellation of gimme constituencies that have been part of the Democratic coalition now for decades. And so Mr. Obama yesterday, as part of what has been a sputtering and surprisingly ineffective PR campaign for this so-called stimulus package, went to Williamsburg, Virginia, and made a really remarkable speech before, of course, a handpicked audience of Democratic Party loyalists, in which he said, among other things, the following. I quote, "I don't care if you're driving a hybrid or SUV. If you're driving toward a cliff, you have to change direction. That's what the American people called for." Of course, that's a very sound and telling point. It worked as an applause line by people.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William's talking about, because the speech was given yesterday by Mr. Obama in Williamsburg, where he used the analogy of it didn't matter what sort of car you were driving, whether it would be an SUV or simply a hybrid, as long as you're heading towards the cliff, you've got to change direction. That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
The trouble is that they're doing everything wrong. They are not trying to solve the problem. The problem really came because, of course, of two sources. One of them, of course, are the faulty housing bonds that were made up of these faulty housing mortgages. And instead of trying to purchase those from places across the world, which they could have done last October with the $700 billion they had, they didn't do it because they did not want to solve the problem. Until people understand that, they do not want to solve the problem. They want to make it worse. That's why the Fed has suddenly begun paying interest on the reserves deposited with them and suddenly dried up $500 billion that could have been lent when with fractional reserve backing. Banking, that would have been about a $5 trillion of money that could have been loaned. It is no longer available. If they wanted to do the right thing, they know what to do. But they made it so complicated the average American doesn't, and they really don't want to solve the problem. Once you understand that, everything going on begins to make sense. Go right ahead, William.
Exactly. The thing that I find really striking about this figure, speech that Obama used in the speech in Williamsburg yesterday, when he talks about the fact that it doesn't matter what kind of vehicle you're driving, you're headed toward a cliff, you have to change direction, that's what we were elected to do. Of course, they're proceeding in the same direction that they were headed under the Bush administration. And what Obama is proposing is that since we're headed toward a cliff, we have to jump on the accelerator. That's the only way that we can avoid disaster, apparently, is by jumping on the accelerator while heading in the same direction. There's no fundamental change of direction under Obama. We didn't expect anything of the sort to happen. What we expected, and of course this is something that Obama has already done and validated our suspicions in every particular, is that he has simply changed somewhat the complexion, the political complexion, if you will, of the recipients of this largesse. It's basically a case of focusing on a certain cluster of domestic constituencies attached to the welfare state, as opposed to the fat cat constituencies attached to the financial elite and those elements of the military-industrial complex that are favored by the Republican Party. That's what happened under Bush the Younger. Mr. Obama has changed, by a very minuscule degree, the preferred lineup or roster of recipients. And apart from that, we're heading in the same direction. The direction, of course, is that is toward absolute, undeniable, unmistakable bankruptcy. And the propellant, of course, is unrestricted deficit spending by the federal government and the creation of inflation by the Federal Reserve and the fractional reserve banking system. What he's doing is he's stepping on the accelerator, and Congress is complicit in it. It's one of those things that is not a matter of party loyalty or race, creed, color, or political persuasion. In Washington, D.C., there is basically one party. It is an establishment party that is divided into two marketable subgroups. They play to slightly different collections of constituencies, but they prescribe exactly the same policy decisions with respect to foreign policy and with respect to domestic policy. In foreign policy, they're all interventionists. They all believe in a mission for this country that is contrary to our founding precepts. They believe that we shouldn't be going abroad. We should be going abroad, contrary to what John Quincy Adams advised us. We should be going abroad in search of monsters to destroy, that we should be entangling ourselves in all the envenomed quarrels of the old world and the oldest of old worlds, the Middle East, in direct contradiction of what George Washington and Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson all agreed should be our foreign policy, which is to remain aloof from those quarrels. These people all believe in some kind of engagement through all these multilateral agencies that are part of this hydra-headed monster, the chief head of which, of course, is the United Nations. They all believe in being involved in all these entangling alliances and all these entangling multilateral entities. They all believe in foreign aid. They all believe in a huge interventionist role for the government in the domestic economy. I mean, even this otherwise estimable and very appealing man, Tom Coburn, the Republican senator from Oklahoma, who gave that stirring speech a couple of days ago condemning the so-called stimulus package, when you pin him to the wall and you put him under the blaring lights of media publicity, and he was put on CNN a couple of days ago in a clip that I watched this afternoon, and he had flung in his face all of the potted talking points and all the prefabricated pseudo-arguments on behalf of the stimulus program, to wit, you're just saying that we should do nothing while the economy collapses, people are being thrown out of work, we have to start spending now, we have no alternative to doing this, you know, all these things that basically tell us to take counsel of our fears and to suspend rational discourse. You put him in that environment, he starts talking about the idea of alternative forms of federal spending. Well, rather than spending on this, we should be spending on that. Rather than spending on make-work programs for Democratic Party welfare state constituencies, we need to be spending on infrastructure in this country. That's one of the things he said specifically. Well, the truth is, we do need to spend on infrastructure in this country, but that's not something government should be doing. We should be getting government out of these roles, freeing up the capital by reducing the size and expense of government and letting the private sector provide. And there are prices that have to be paid, there are settlements that have to be reached, there are accounts that have to be settled. That would incur some pain. Pain is not something we like, but sometimes pain is nature's way of repairing the damage that has been done. But if we were to take the course I'm describing right now, that of radically reducing the size of government and restoring sound money to the economy, we'd be able to turn everything around in a matter of maybe 3, 5, or 7 years. As is happening right now, they're literally destroying the economy. We're heading the way of Zimbabwe in terms of the inflation profile of our central bank and its appurtenances and affiliates. And so they're talking about bringing about unprecedented economic and financial catastrophe, and they're panicking people into supporting this. I think that if you take a core sample of the headlines and editorials being put out by the familiar organs of mass deception, the New York Times, Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the evening newscasts, all of them are saying basically the same thing. We have to have this spending because the only way that we get out of an economic downturn is for government to take an ever bigger role in the economy, start pumping out money, or what they call liquidity by way of a useful euphemism, so as to preserve us from further economic destruction, job loss, and horrors of that kind. And this is something else that Obama said in that speech in Williamsburg when he expressed some puzzlement over the fact that people were criticizing the so-called stimulus package by saying it was merely a huge spending program. And what he said by way of a reaction to that was, quote, "What do you think stimulus is? That's the point." In other words, the only way, from Obama's perspective, that you can actually stimulate economic growth is for the government to steal wealth from the productive and then redirect it as it sees fit based on political metrics rather than on market signals. This is a perfect illustration of the fact that Mr. Obama, despite his charming and urbane veneer, despite the fact that he has a certain self-possession about him that I find quite appealing, that appeals to young people in particular, he seems like a likable enough guy. He's got a beautiful family. But folks, he's a Marxist down to his chromosomes. He cannot conceptualize the world in any way that doesn't involve central planning, massive government intervention, and government supervision of the entire economy. It just makes no sense to him. From his perspective, economic growth is something that government provides, something that government produces, and that those of us who have aspirations to operate in the private sector, whatever goes on in the private sector beyond government control, that goes on basically by the forbearance of government. It's by the grace of the state that there's any private investment, any private enterprise in this country, because what really works from Obama's perspective is government intervention.
You know, I think it's really what the average American doesn't understand is this idea that they have said there are certain banks that are too large to fail, so we've got, of course, to bail them out. What they do never talk about, Bank of America and Wells Fargo, both of these banks are insolvent, two of our largest banks that are too large to fail. But together, those two banks have, between credit default swaps and derivatives, about $70 trillion of liabilities, $70 trillion. Now, remember that the budget of the United States is a little over $3 trillion. You know, the entire capitalization of the entire stock market is about $12 trillion. If we take everything in this country, it's probably worth $30 or $40 trillion. And yet they have said, well, we're going to just go ahead and guarantee these banks. We're taking on an additional debt of somewhere in the neighborhood of $60 trillion. Now, where's the money going to come from? Well, government doesn't have any money. It has to either tax the people. Well, we can't tax the people. They wouldn't stand for having to give everything they earn to the government over a period of the next 20 years, because that's the only way you could come up with that amount of money. And then, of course, they can always simply borrow it, but who's going to lend money to a country, to a government that has that sort of debt? Would you? And a third alternative is to simply print the money and pay the debts off that way. But when you print the money, you destroy the value of the existing money. And when William talks about the fact we're headed the way of Zimbabwe, that's exactly where they are. They just issued a new $50 trillion note. Maybe soon it'll be a $500 trillion note. It really doesn't have any relevance. What they have done, they've decided to do, and they're not telling the American people, is to destroy the value of our currency, to destroy the infrastructure of this nation. And at that point, we will have no alternative other than the New World Order, which is what this is really about. We're going to be back in just a moment with our special guest, Mr. William Grigg. All right, William, go right ahead.
You know, it's interesting that you bring up Zimbabwe. And we talk about Zimbabwe practically every time I'm on the program for very good reason. And once again, I have to reiterate my hunch. And it's a hunch, but it's a hunch that's rooted in an appreciation of the personality and the inclinations of this ruling elite that we're dealing with. However you want to characterize them, if you want to talk about them as the power elite, which is my preferred description in large measure, because I don't see how you can deny that there is a global power elite. We see them operating in open, although most of what is really important things that are done by the power elite is done behind closed doors and beyond the scrutiny of television cameras and inquisitive microphones. you want to call them the power elite, you want to call them the insiders, if you want to call them what you will, the ruling oligarchy, if you understand their inclinations, their objectives, my hunch about Zimbabwe, I think, makes sense, and that is that they're using Zimbabwe as sort of a controlled experiment in economic and socio-political chaos, because never before in the history of mankind, at least that I'm aware of, has hyperinflation been allowed to run as rampantly as it has in Zimbabwe. And there was a piece just a couple of days ago that I found very arresting. It talked about Patrick Chinamasa, who is the finance minister in Zimbabwe. Actually, forgive me, it was Gideon Gono. He's the governor of the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe. Gideon Gono is the equivalent of their Federal Reserve Bank. But they have arbitrarily slashed 12 zeros from their currency in order to curb hyperinflation. What they did, of course, was they simply said that rather than the top denomination being, I can't remember what it would be, but rather than it being that larger number, we're going to delete 12 zeros from it and bring it back into a tighter parity with a dollar. Now, of course, that assumes that the government of Zimbabwe or any other government, any other central bank, has the ability to do that, that it can prescribe by fiat the value of its currency against some other currency that is, momentarily more stable because it's being considered more desirable. The fiat dollar, the U.S. dollar, has undergone something of a last-ditch rally because there's a general deleveraging going on in world financial markets. People are getting out of a lot of their positions. That means that they're cashing out. They're cashing out of dollar-denominated assets, which means that they have to have dollars. That's why there's a demand for the dollar right now. That's why Treasury notes have been doing relatively well, and a lot of people believe that they'll continue to do well, but I believe that's an entirely fallacious assumption. I believe that's an entirely futile hope. So the people who are much more successful than I am financially, Jim Rogers being conspicuous among that group. But here we have the Zimbabwean dollar, the top denomination, just arbitrarily removing 12 zeros. Now, I can't imagine currency that would have 12 zeros behind whatever number is embossed upon that slip of paper. But the Zimbabwean central government once again believes that it can print as much of this so-called money as it pleases and then denominate it as it sees fit to do so, and that the market will sustain this. Well, of course it won't. They're simply biding time. They're simply treading water. And from what I see, we're basically in the same boat here in the United States, the biggest difference being that for the nonce, for the foreseeable future, the dollar remains the world's reserve currency. This will not be the case within a couple of years, within 4 or 5 years the most, I believe. I don't see how that can continue. I just don't see how, in order to...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back again. Okay, our guest is certainly William Grigg. He's talking about the fact that in Zimbabwe, they've recently announced that to curb inflation, they're going to simply knock 12 zeros off the currency and try to bring it back in some line with something else. But that doesn't really change the situation over there. You can say change the amount, you know, number of zeros in the Zimbabwean dollar, but suddenly you've wiped out the savings of people. You've totally impoverished the people there. They're starving. Half the population's fed. People are leaving their homes and going to other countries to refugee camps with the hope that there'll be some food there. But this seems to be a massive experiment just to see how you would go ahead creating massive inflation.
Yeah.
This is exactly what they're planning to do here. Ladies and gentlemen, the derivatives that are held simply by Bank of America and by Wells Fargo are somewhere in the neighborhood of, and the credit default swaps, are between 60 and 70 trillion dollars. That's more than everything in the United States is worth together. So understand that we have accepted responsibility for those two banks. And remember, of course, that J.P. Morgan Chase by itself has derivatives that, well, before they absorbed Bear Stearns, they stood at about 80 trillion dollars of derivatives now. We've said we are going to redeem them. How can we possibly redeem them? Let them go bankrupt.
Yeah.
Let the people who are foolish enough to have bought the bonds, let them go bankrupt as well. Would you rather they went bankrupt or that we destroyed the value of our currency? I believe they intend to destroy the value of our currency, impoverish our people, and of course, the end of freedom as we know it. But you go ahead, William.
Yeah, we are confronted with a prospect here that is, in many ways, a self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, one of the reasons I keep going back to the Zimbabwe is because the people running that government, as we never tire pointing out, were brought to power by the United States State Department, by the British Foreign Ministry. They were imposed upon that country. They're propped up. They've been maintained in that position by the United States and Great Britain. And as the flames of hyperinflation devour that country, it seems as if London and Washington continue to pour kerosene on this Holocaust. The only reason why they would do that, I believe, is I think they want to know just how far they can push this process. And you take a look at Zimbabwe as a nation in terms of the assets it had. It was, in terms of its agricultural wealth, the richest country in Africa. It was the breadbasket of that entire continent, that entire undeveloped, largely undeveloped continent. At one point, according to Lou Rockwell of the Mises Institute, I just recently heard an interview with him where he was discussing a conversation or a set of conversations he had back in the 70s with a man of his acquaintance who was an investment banker and got out of that business and wanted to relocate to what was then called Rhodesia. This fellow pointed out that Zimbabwe had the richest volcanic soil in the known world. There were places where the topsoil, the volcanic soil in Zimbabwe was literally, the depth of it went to feet rather than inches, something in the order of yards of topsoil, volcanic topsoil, incredibly rich, incredibly fertile. How do you go about taking a country that is that naturally blessed and turning it into a blighted country where famine is claiming the lives of people, dysentery and cholera run rampant, where people literally have nothing to eat, they're dying from stagnant drinking water, they're unable to find anything to forage, and so they're reduced literally to eating dead dogs and other offal of that variety? Well, you do that by giving a government total power over the agricultural sector, letting them ruin that, and then giving them total power over the economy, letting them ruin the currency so people can't import anything to live on. That's going on in the wealthiest country in Africa right now with the connivance of these power elites in London and Washington. And you take a look once again at the debt profile of the United States government and the banking system, which by definition is a fiat currency, fractional reserve system, is bankrupt. You mentioned the credit default swaps. You mentioned the other derivatives, which are basically, if you want to know what a derivative is, take a picture of a photograph, not an actual financial security like a bond or some other security, be it negotiable or not. Take a picture of that security and then take that picture and put it in a mirror and then put another mirror to where you can see a reflection of the first mirror. That's how the derivatives markets work. You don't really have anything that has any actual value in it. It's like the second generation reflection of a picture of a security that may not have value. And a lot of these derivatives, the first generation of these derivatives, the securities that begin this process, are based on bad loans that nobody wants to accept because they're all based on the lunatic investments that went on during the era of loose money and credit that came to an abrupt and unpleasant end about a year and a half ago.
But William, of course, those were actually encouraged. I mean,
yes.
It was Alan Greenspan encouraging people to take on these adjustable rate mortgages, these other creative mortgages. They knew what they were doing. They created this problem. When are the American people going to wake up and realize that there are lots of people out there screaming, don't you realize this is going to destroy our system? And they were very effectively silenced, like Elliot Spitzer. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess William Grigg, and William, go right ahead.
Well, there are a couple of issues that were brought up just before this last break that are really in need of being fleshed out. And you talk about the intentional nature of what we're dealing with here, the malignant, malicious intent behind our predicament, the fact that this is something that was encouraged not merely in terms of people encouraged to go out and take on more debt than they could possibly manage, and not only in terms of the fact that the Federal Reserve created this huge gusher of what they call liquidity, but the fact that a lot of the lunatic things that were going on in the derivatives market represent deliberate policy here. I really think that what we're dealing with, as you point out, and we've talked about on numerous occasions, is a deliberate effort to reduce the middle class of the United States to a form of helotry. That is to say, we would be in a type of pre-medieval vassalage or serfdom or servitude. A lot of people think that we're going to be going back to feudalism. Actually, feudalism will be quite pleasant compared to the situation we'll find ourselves in. Feudalism was a form of delirious extravagance compared to what was done to the proletariat in the so-called workers' republics, like the former Soviet Union, China under Mao, or North Korea today. The feudal serf of high medieval era would have been considered wealthy and gloriously free compared to the typical proletarian. Well, that's sort of the direction we're headed right now. The biggest difference is, of course, that we're not heading in a strictly orthodox Marxist direction. We're seeing this huge consolidation on the part of the corporatocracy, the government-wedded corporate interests and financial interests in Wall Street. Everything is being done right now for the express purpose of ensuring that their position is secure when the new financial and political architecture is established and we're ushered into whatever system awaits us. And the lineaments of that system, of course, are taking shape right now. Mr. Kissinger was sent to Moscow. If I'm not mistaken, he was sent to Moscow during the interregnum, or the effective interregnum between the election and the inauguration, at a time when Mr. Bush was a lame duck and Barack Obama was still merely the president-elect. Henry Kissinger was sent over there to talk with Putin and others about another nuclear arms control regime. And anytime you're talking about nuclear arms reduction, eventually you're talking about building up some kind of a mechanism, a supervisory mechanism, through the United Nations to administer arms control or arms reduction. And the long-range plan is to have either the United Nations or a successor organization.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here with all of our stations. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, is William Grigg, and we're certainly talking about what's going on financially. And, of course, William was talking about Henry Kissinger going over to Moscow just a short period of time ago to talk about new arms, nuclear arms control. And, of course, if you're going to have nuclear arms control, you have to have a supranational organization who will regulate this. And, of course, everything is going to be done by outside organizations regulating every aspect of what goes on here in the United States. That's what it's all about. Timothy Geithner talks about how we're going to have other organizations, of course, regulating our economy after all. But what's wrong with that? We already have a World Bank. We already have certainly a World Police Force. We already have World Trade officials. You know, why shouldn't we have a financial regulators? But it's all about regulations. It's all about the New World Order. Before we go on, William, I'd like you to go ahead and get out your blog site, tell people how they can get in touch with your material, and then we'll go ahead and proceed.
Well, I really appreciate that. I have a blog site called Pro Libertate, which is a 3 to 5 times updated weblog that contains essays usually ranging anywhere from 900 words up to several thousand. Typically, they're between 1,200 and 1,800 words. And I say that by way of admonition, advisory to anybody who wants to go check it out, because it is a longer form of essay than most bloggers generate. Most blogs are much more digestible. They're much more, to be blunt, reader-friendly in terms of the length. I try to make the essays as reader-friendly as possible. I try to keep the pace somewhat sprightly and try to avoid getting them bogged down in self-indulgent diction, but as a writer, every once in a while, I can't help myself. But the essays are between 1,200 and 1,800 words, and they're illustrated, and I do my best using hyperlinks and videos and audios and other tools that are available in this wonderful digital age we're living in to document and authenticate what I'm saying, as well as making citations from works which are not yet available in digital form. The easiest way to get to Pro Libertate is to go to my intro website, which is called willgrigg.com. Once again, that's willgrigg.com. And to get to Pro Libertate, you look at the right-hand corner, basically the upper right-hand corner of that page, and at the top of the external links collection, you'll find Pro Libertate. And as well, through either willgrigg.com or through Pro Libertate, it's possible to have access to my book. My most recent book is entitled Liberty in Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. It's available through Amazon.com. If you read to the end of any of the essays, there's a photograph of the cover of that book right next to a hyperlink that will take you to Amazon to order that book. It's been available as well through Radio Liberty, and I need to get on my associates down in California, New Mexico, to make sure to get another supply of that book to you to sell.
We'd love to get some, thank you.
It's about 320 pages long, and it's meant to be at once an expose and sort of a clinical history of how we ended up with the police state we're living in right now. Now, a lot of people might dispute the assessment that we're living in a police state as opposed to heading toward a police state. I believe that we're living in a police state of relatively mild, character as far as such things go. The problem is that we're living under such persistent, arbitrary state supervision, surveillance, and regimentation that people who do nothing to offend the rights or to transgress upon the property of other people or to offend decent public order can often find themselves on the receiving end of sudden and largely inexplicable state violence. There's a growing insecurity of your fundamental freedom of travel, your fundamental freedom of expression, and the basic security of your person with respect to what the government can do to you at any time. Those are the symptoms of a police state, albeit one that's in the early stages of its development. And in the book, I talk about how we got here, how bad it's likely to get, and how we can take some steps back from where we are right now. One of the most encouraging developments, ironically enough, would be the literal bankruptcy of our country, because if you bankrupt the bankruptcy of the regime, the country itself, of course, would go bankrupt if the regime simply stole all of our wealth in order to pay off its debts, which is something we discussed in a previous segment. That's not what I want to see happen. I want to see the government go bankrupt. That would be a good thing in that it would give us an opportunity to rein in the government that's ruling us right now and to reboot it on constitutional principles. That would be a really rough way to go about it, but it would certainly be better than having the government strong enough literally to confiscate all of the wealth of the country in the futile effort to pay back this astronomical debt that the government has managed to accrue. But in Liberty and Eclipse, I talk a little bit about some of the ways that we can mitigate what's going on and hopefully go about the business of restoring constitutional order, which begins with restraining what the government can do. I wish that one American in, say, 50 or one in 100 understood that that is the most important thing that law does, is restrain what government can do. There was a time when that was common knowledge in this country, and now we believe that the highest and most important value that that the government represents is in its ability to steal from one group of people to enrich others, and so we always want to be on the receiving end of that transaction. That's what happens when you see a republic of a constitutional nature degenerate into a mass democracy of the sort we're living with right now. Some of the other things I'd like to mention here is that I do write quite frequently for LouRockwell.com. I mentioned Lou Rockwell in an earlier segment. Mr. Rockwell is the president of the Mises Institute. He's a wonderful man who has a wonderful website of a very forthright and unflinching libertarian nature. I publish on that website and also publish on their blog quite frequently. And Mr. Rockwell has a series of podcasts, which are just say audio programs or radio interviews that are archived on his site. He has a number of very, very important interviews with the likes of Peter Schiff from Euro-Pacific Capital, who's been one of the most astute and, I believe, invaluable analysts of our unfolding economic and financial collapse. He was an economic advisor to Ron Paul's presidential campaign. He has several interviews in the podcast section. I have an interview in the podcast section talking about the militarization of the police. That's worth, I believe, listening to because it does go into greater depth and detail on many of the subjects that I talk about in my book than I usually do in many radio interviews. There are also a couple of interviews with Gerald Celente, who is a trends analyst from New York who's like Mr. Schiff, one of the most astute observers of what's been happening over the last several years. And Mr. Salenti, like Peter Schiff, very accurately called the advent of the ongoing economic collapse well in advance, years in advance, and gave great detailed and very prescient warning about what we could expect. Mr. Salenti, having grown up in the Bronx and having gone through 9/11 and a number of other terrible experiences of that sort, is very, very much of the opinion that Americans should be prepared right now for the likelihood of widespread civil unrest and the concomitant crackdown by government on personal liberty and financial liberty in this country. They need to be ready for that, because that's going to become a reality very quickly, according to Mr. Salenti. Given his track record, I think he's worth listening to. Once again, his interviews are archived at Lou Rockwell's website, which I think is a really good place to visit. One other thing that I want to mention here that is something of a new undertaking that I think is very worthy. My friend Tom Edlam, who is the former research director of the John Birch Society and the New American Magazine, has recently started a campaign urging people who are investors not to buy federal debt. That is to say, not to buy T-bills, not to buy savings bonds, not to buy any of this debt, because this, of course, is all bad debt. What you're doing, of course, if you buy these debts, you people who are involved in the international purchase of treasury bills and other instruments of that sort, are simply perpetuating a fraud, the digging us ever more deeply into a hole from which we will not be able to recover. And so in order to bring about genuine recovery, what you have to do is you have to take away the credit card from the people who are spending us into oblivion. And so Mr. Edlam published yesterday on Lou Rockwell's website, I think a spectacular essay called Don't Buy Bad Federal Debt. He wants to start a viral campaign urging people who would be in a position to buy T-bills and other notes of that sort not to buy them, in the hope that this will actually have an impact on the decisions made by investors internationally. Now, of course, that would mean that the T-bills would lose their value, and that would mean that the dollar would collapse. But it's going to collapse anyway. Tom's reasoning is that it's better to collapse from an altitude of, say, 100 feet than it would be to collapse from an altitude of 10,000 feet. And we are talking about options that are that stark and that disagreeable. Mr. Edlam has created a Facebook site for what he calls the Deficit Obliteration Squad. Go to Lou Rockwell's archive for Friday, the 6th of February, and look at the lead article, the lead headline, which is Tom Edlam's Don't Buy Bad Federal Debt. I think that's something worth looking at and worth considering. I just don't see how anybody in good conscience can be involved in perpetuating the charade much longer, or any longer at all. And as you point out, Dr. Stan, we're dealing here with a palpable fraud, because if the government were to confiscate everything that we earn, everything that we make, everything that we own here in this country, you wouldn't go halfway toward paying off or toward absorbing the bad debts that are out there in the global derivatives market. So obviously what they're trying to do is they are trying to put us in a position of utter penury. They want to divest us of everything that we own. They want to consolidate all the wealth in the hands of the plutocratic corporate fascist or socialist elite. And they'll do this by increments as large as we let them get away with. And so we're at a point now where either they are permitted to do this, either they're permitted to expropriate us, or we bring down the system by simply not allowing them to run up any more debt.
Well, of course, the interesting thing, certainly I don't have any T-bills, but let's imagine that I was a wealthy individual. I had $1 million in T-bills. Well, what would I do with the money? People are putting the money into T-bills because they don't know where else to put it.
Exactly.
They're afraid to put it into banks. They're afraid, yes, just to hold it, you know, in a mattress at home. What do you do when you have a large sum of money? How do you protect that money? That is the $48,000 question,
yes,
at the present time. And people are investing in T-bills, not necessarily because they want to, but because they don't know where else to go. So what would you tell them?
I would tell them that what they should do, first of all, if they've got their debts paid off, which is a good thing to do, and if they've got If they have a great deal of ready cash on hand, and then, of course, gold and silver as their primary means of holding their money in something tangible in contrast to a banking account, a savings account, or a CD or something of that sort, they've done that, they should put it in something that is of immediate and inescapable value. And what I'm talking about, of course, will be that they need to stock up their pantries with food that will last for a long, long time. In a situation of severe civil unrest, like you see in Zimbabwe right now, there is simply no substitute for being able to eat adequate food and drink clean water. And so if you're in a position where you're financially secure and you're otherwise materially comfortable, and rather than investing money right now in something that would be tied up in the financial markets or in the banking system, a banking system which is going to collapse, I'd suggest that you put it in storage food, a food storage of various kinds that can be kept on hand, and the means of acquiring and maintaining a supply of clean drinking water. And if you've got that and you're well supplied for a period of, let's say, 2 years, there are ways that you can calculate that. And I know that you, Dr. Stander, are involved in several efforts to help people acquire that type of indispensable provision. That they ought to look into the possibility of having some kind of an autonomous generator so they can have electric power to maintain some civilized standard of living. Once again, we're talking about people who are at the higher end of the economic spectrum right now, and those amenities are going to be priceless, I believe, because we are going to see disruptions of the supply chain that takes food to supermarkets. When finally we end up with the hyperinflation that's being put in store for us right now, you're going to see disruptions, you're going to see shortages, you're going to see policies enacted by the central government supposedly to mitigate these problems that will exacerbate them instead. Both Peter Schiff and Gerald Celentin and a number of other very capable and sagacious commentators have speculated that we're going to see not only an effort perhaps to confiscate gold again, which would mean, by the way, that you should invest in the third of the noble metals. The two noble metals everybody talks about are gold and silver. The third one is lead, lead in the form of ammunition. I hate to say it, but that's something that has to be part of the equation. But in addition to all of this, we have to bear in mind that there are probably going to be restrictions placed on the export of capital from the United States. That would work very naturally off of the things that are being done right now to restrict the movement of Americans abroad. I've often said that a lot of these policies that are being put in place by way of supposed immigration reform have nothing to do with addressing the problem of illegal immigration, but rather they're trying to build fences of some kinds to keep us, or at least to keep our capital, in the United States. That's something that's talked about in the Communist Manifesto. It talks about the seizure of the assets of all emigrants and rebels. And also that's a policy which has been enacted by every totalitarian state since the Jacobins took over France back in the 1790s. So you can probably predict that as well. Everything they do is going to proceed logically from the failed premises of socialism. When Obama and the Democrats and the Republicans find that their so-called stimulus package doesn't revive the economy, they're going to redouble their efforts. They're going to redouble their efforts while pursuing the same course that led us to disaster. And in process of time, as the logical economic consequences of inflation start to make themselves felt, you're going to see price controls, you're going to see wage controls, you're going to see every effort made to control artificially something that is the logical outworking of monetary inflation. And the result will be, of course, shortages. People are not going to be willing to produce the goods that would have to sell at inflated prices at an artificially low government-set price. And as a result, we're going to have severe hardships and dislocations resulting from that. So I would advise somebody who is in a position to buy T-bills because he's afraid of putting his money in a bank or in some other financial instrument, rather than doing that, go out and buy gold and silver while you still can. Take physical possession of them. Do not buy paper. You know, do not buy a note from an exchange-traded fund. Don't buy something that would be a claim ticket on a physical quantity of gold or a physical quantity of silver. Take physical possession of it and put it somewhere where nobody but you knows where it is. It'd be a good idea to to find some way of concealing where you're putting it, and to perhaps even to lay a phony rabbit trail to a different destination. Always think in terms of the possibility that not only predators of the private sort, but predators of the official sort will be after what you just purchased. Take physical possession of these precious metals, and then take physical possession of the means of sustenance for you and those who depend upon you for as long as you possibly can. If you can, lay away food storage for 2 years and have some means of providing a steady supply of clean drinking water.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. All right, William, you've got just 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
I'm sorry to wax apocalyptic here, but I'm thinking, as the father of 6 children and a wonderful wife, who is worried about the possibility that we're going to be living through tumultuous times of the sort that do lead to apocalyptic thoughts. And if I were in a position of the sort that you described, Dr. Stan, if I were somebody who had discretionary income that permitted me to buy T-bills, I'm describing what I would do. As somebody of modest means and large responsibilities, if I had the type of financial resources that permitted me to buy T-bills, I would be cashing out of all of those financial instruments and doing what I just described, thinking in terms of being able to live off the grid if necessary. But that doesn't mean that I would retreat from the fight. The only way that we will lose eventually is if we retreat from the battlefield and leave it in the uncontested hands of the enemy. And we have to fight smarter. We have to fight in terms of informing people about what's going on, explaining to them why we're being driven into the desperate straits that confront us right now. We have to be the countervailing voice of truth to counteract the deranged propaganda that is being broadcast by every instrument of mass indoctrination that the establishment has at its disposal right now. And I do think that people are starting to listen because they understand the fundamental logic of what our rulers are trying to do. They understand that it is the excess of spending and debt that has gotten us into this position, that we're not going to cure our problems by pursuing the same policies. They understand that Mr. Obama was saying something completely illogical when he was talking about the need to make an abrupt change of direction before we approach the cliff, when in fact what he is doing, not what he's saying he's doing, but what he is doing is jumping on the accelerator rather than yanking the steering wheel in a different direction. We have to head into a different direction, and if all of us start heading in a different direction, or if enough of us start heading in a different direction to make a material difference, eventually those who call themselves our leaders will have no choice but to follow. And I think that we're coming up on the time, a very abrupt break point in our history where eventually the reality is going to be undeniable to anybody who's halfway intelligent, halfway honest. And perhaps this year or next year, we're going to have a real opportunity to make some positive changes because all the other alternatives will have been played out and futile.
I agree with you. We're entering some of the worst times I've seen. I've been at this for 46 years. But we're going into a time of crisis. We're going to see how many people out there who really care about freedom. Then they're going to have to listen sooner or later. And we have an army of people out there telling others, let's just hope enough people wake up in time. We're out of time, William. God bless. Thanks so very much.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
God bless.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we hope that you enjoyed William Grigg, and certainly he's talking about the very real problems we face. Certainly, first of all, you have to be ensure that you're in good shape as far as the Lord is concerned. If you don't have a personal relationship with the Lord, why, let me suggest, we've got some excellent DVDs put out by Pastor Billy Crone, and he ends up every one of those DVDs asking you where you're going to spend eternity, how you can be sure where you're going to spend eternity, and what you can do to ensure that you'll be there with the brethren who've accepted the Lordship of our Jesus Christ. Certainly the DVD sets, the final countdown, parts 1 and 2, each one with 5 DVDs in it. Creation, parts 1 and 2, each with 5 DVDs. The RFID identification with 4 DVDs, and we'll be ordering more when we get organized enough. We're watching a great one now. Is how do you know that the Bible is the Word of God? Fascinating set, and we'll be stocking these and many of the others because his message is important. But not only that, but he ends every message with that invitation. and to accept the Lordship of Jesus Christ. Well, let me just suggest we've got some great new books in. We're going to be carrying Jim Marr's book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich. We have in stock right now Target Patton. You need to understand that they killed General Patton because he would not go along with the establishment. He knew, of course, that how we were doing everything we could to help the communists, and once they moved into Eastern Europe, they literally raped every woman there. Now, you'll never hear about this through the media, but you can go up on the Internet and, of course, type in the great rape of this, sort of Eastern Europe at the end of the Second World War. Why did our government stand by and allow that to happen? Why were we financing the government, the Russian government, that allowed that brutality? Because we had evil people in our government at that time, and specifically, of course, at that time why we had Harry Truman there. And you must understand, Harry Truman came from the occult just exactly as Franklin Delano Roosevelt came from the occult. And they were deeply involved in spiritualism, at least Franklin and Eleanor were, and of course Harry Truman was a 33rd degree Mason, who carried in his wallet all of his life a poem dealing with how we were going to have a one world government. And so the DVD we have is called The Eye of the Phoenix. You need to get it, you need to watch it, and you need to get the information to others, put out by Chris Pinto. 2 hours and 50 minutes, fascinating about the emblem on the back of the dollar bill. And, of course, why Franklin Delano Roosevelt put that emblem there. And then, of course, we also have the part one and part two of the series, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginnings. The Riddles in Stone, you need to get those. You need, of course, get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to get our four-tape set on the supernatural and the book that goes with that, The Beautiful Side of Evil. You need to get the four-tape set, The Wisdom of Malachi Martin, and the book that goes with that, Hostage to the Devil, the story of five exorcisms recorded and verified by the Catholic Church. And, of course, what happened to these five people who were actually demonically possessed. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, there are some people who are demonically possessed, and some of those people are operating today at the highest levels of our government. If you doubt that, why, we'll be glad to send you free of charge, if you get anything else, a little pamphlet called The Working of the Spiritual Hierarchy. It's published by the Luciferians, and they tell you how their agents actually, their spirits are inhabiting and controlling the minds of the leaders all across the world. This is not what I say. You can go to their website, LuciusTrust.org. LuciusTrust.org. Understand, this is not imaginary. It's real. We are involved in the spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. And the wicked people are in positions of control, and they control the wealth of the world because they've made a bargain with the devil. If you haven't yet seen the DVDs, They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. That's They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. You need to get them. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. If you want information on long-term food storage, Berkey water filters, certainly on the health products that you need, give us a call. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival, but pray for greater liberty, for our provision and our protection.